She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. This is Gina Murphy, darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, an inspirational and informative place where we never tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thanks so much for joining us and for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. And as always, a big thanks to the sponsor of this show, the Fairfax Companies, true leaders in the business of sustainability. Since its inception, the company has strived to be a leader in sustainability and is dedicated to improving the environment through creative and innovative management practices, and indeed they do. Thank you, Fairfax, for your support of the Mrs. Green's World mission and vision, and for everything you do to make our community and our planet safer and healthier. And you know, everybody, just get ready for another, like, show that's going to rock it. And I rarely talk about what it's like for me to prepare for these shows, but what happens almost every time when you have a guest like we're going to have for this next hour, it's like hashtag OMG. And I go down the rabbit hole and I get distracted and I start reading more stories. And then I always say, I am so happy to be Mrs. Green. So without further ado, with that personal share, please join me in welcoming Ariel Greenwood. You're not going to believe it. Like, by the end of this show, you're going to say, what? She is the feral agrarian. She lives in the Greater Bay Area on a 4,000-acre ecological preserve where, are you ready? She manages a herd of cattle as a grazier. And I hope I'm saying that right, Ariel. I think grazier, right? How else would you say it? For holistic ag, and we're going to hear all about that. She also manages the orchard at Occidental Arts and Ecology Center and works with an organization called Fibershed, which I also want you to hear all about. And all three of these could be entire shows. So, Ariel, can you tell I'm a little excited about having you on Mrs. Green's World Show?
Your enthusiasm is very flattering. It's really nice to be on the show with you, Gina.
But seriously, I heard you at Bioneers, and I went in as, you know, just don't eat beef, don't eat beef. And I came out with my head spinning, lots to think about. And the whole intentionality of it, you can't just paint a broad stroke and there's not a silver bullet when we're talking about climate change. And what you're doing will be revealed, but it really mitigates climate change, in my opinion. I made that decision after I heard you at Bioneers and then said, got to get her on the show. So you changed my relationship with beef. Let's just say that.
Cool.
I love seeing the word herdist. I don't think I've ever interviewed a herdist before. I don't think I ever met one either. And you're living the life of a naturalist. And I know that you have a really hard job. And I mean in terms of physical labor. I helped friends out on a cattle ranch down near us in Sonoyta. And after 2 days, some of my friends were saying, I would love this. And I said, if I die and go to hell, I will do this. Because it is so freaking hard and relentless. Like, you have to do it. You have to show up. You have to keep going. And it's not like, you know, we were there because they were at a cattleman's show. And it is a lot of work. And I say that from a place of high praise. So talk about your life. And you can take the next 20 minutes to talk about, you know, what you do in a day, the animals you raise, and how you take care of the land. So you go. It's all about you. I just love it.
Oh, wow. It's so open-ended.
It is. I can be more specific, too. Believe me.
It's all good. I can start to ramble, and then please jump in whenever you see fit, because I enjoy the conversation about it. The term you used, feral agrarian, it's kind of funny. I think I coined it, but it makes me laugh nonetheless because I was sort of looking for a term that described somebody who is sort of on the edge of agriculture, which is the place that I feel most useful and where I feel most at home. And looking around, a lot of my peers who are agrarians through and through, but maybe farmer doesn't exactly fit. Maybe we don't own the land that we're working. Maybe we are intentionally mobile. There needed to be another term thrown in there. And I enjoy playing with words and ideas and the interrelationship between the two. And so
I love really... it. Like, I just have to say, I love it. Like, what the heck is that? It's like a feral cat. You know what I mean? It just, it makes you start thinking about what does that even mean? So, yes, yeah. Now you're telling us, and I love it, on the edge of agriculture. Sure. And it's not like a farmer. Yeah. You're not a farmer, and you're not a cattle rancher either, because you do so much more. So do go on.
Sure. Yeah, it's been interesting kind of struggling with my own identity in all of this, and I'm sure the reckoning will continue. I mean, I'm 26, and I've been in agriculture in some form or fashion since I was 16, so for a decade, but... You know, I've never lived the life of what I always saw was the sort of quintessential small-scale diversified farmer, you know, who either owned or leased their land and grew row crop vegetables and maybe had some bees and chickens and so on. And it's interesting to watch the slow, organic, et cetera, food scene across the world, but here in, you know, my home country of the U.S., grow and spread and diversify in its own right, just like these farms are diversifying. So I've struggled with a lot of I think they call it imposter syndrome, because you know, for a while
you were a hashtag waiting to happen. I'm telling you, imposter syndrome,
it's a total thing, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners who are in agriculture in some form or fashion can maybe relate, as you know, as we all can, because our world, our professional world, is sliced and diced into these job titles, these descriptions, and yet we all know every human is so much more than that, and the real most meaningful work is often situated across a lot of professions. So, for example, you know, my last year of college, I was in school full-time, but I was also working full-time for actually a software company on the East Coast, employed as a culinary farmer. That was my job title. And yet, you know, I didn't feel comfortable calling myself a farmer around my, you know, friends who were on the rural outskirts of town and working 70 hours a week on their own land, you know, hauling food to the farmer's market and filling CSA boxes and so on. Because I was working at a really sort of posh company and had like a guaranteed salary and whatnot. So
right. Very
we were
different.
Still driving the same.
Very
yeah,
different.
We were still driving yeah. the same tractors, and we were still doing the same work in the greenhouse and in the field. And yet the context was, you know, in my situation, a lot more, I would say, humane, because I think a lot of farming can be inhumane to the people doing it, but I digress. So, you know, what my kind of feral agrarianism looks like right now is, a little bit as you described, I'm sort of resident grazer on this ecological preserve called Pepperwood Preserve in Sonoma County. And but it's interesting. I'm out here, and yet I don't actually work directly for Pepperwood, but I work very closely with the ecologists and land managers here. I'm instead employed as sort of an independent contractor with this company, Holistic Ag. And the premise of Holistic Ag is essentially we use land grazing and animal impact to enhance the health of grasslands and watersheds. So using animals as a tool, using ranching as a means to a more regenerative end. You know, and the land that we access sometimes is land that has been traditionally grazed by cattle in what's a common form of cattle management called set stock grazing, which is essentially where you turn animals out into maybe a 20-acre, maybe a 1,000-acre area, often with permanent perimeter fence, and, you know, let them graze down the grass. And once there's not enough forage to sustain them much longer, a rancher will move the herd to another land base or another paddock or pasture.
Right.
And that works fine some of the year. It works fine when grasses are totally dormant. But because the phenology of California grasslands is just really so subject to our seasonal rainfall. If you let cattle stay in one area too long, they'll end up overgrazing. And overgrazing is essentially when a plant is grazed a second time before it's had a chance to recover. So overgrazing actually has a lot less to do with how low a plant, low to the ground a plant is eaten down, and a lot more to do with how long it goes in between its being grazed by animals again. So with Holistic Ag, we practice holistic plant grazing, which is the sort of grazing application of holistic management, which I can certainly speak more about. And what that means is that we work closely with the preserve here to consolidate and coordinate their ecological and management goals with our, you know, our management goals. My boss, Aaron Lucich, started this company with ecological imperatives. You know, he wanted to work within the existing ranching world to change it and also change anywhere that he grazes animals for the better. So this is very much his brainchild that I've cut my teeth on grazing in and learned to operate. And, you know, there's no better place to learn how to graze within the keeping of the confines of our ecology, the ecological preserve.
Then home on the range. I mean, I was thinking all kinds of things as I'm doing the research for this. I mean, it's just, and believe me, you're not rambling. You're telling a kick-ass story. And I don't usually say profanity on the air, but it's like, yes, just keep telling us what it's like. And I can circle back to what it actually means because of my, you know, experience with interviewing people about even like grasslands and how important they are and how they're disappearing and why overgrazing is so bad. And you're mitigating that. You're changing that and really changing the whole landscape of what it means to raise cattle in those areas.
Well, I'm trying to do my part, and there's a lot of ways to go about it. You know, when I first started here, I had worked with some animals in the past, but just like, you know, pigs and goats for a few months. I grew up with horses and chickens and whatnot, but I hadn't really been in any kind of production agriculture setting with animals prior to a few years ago. So I hope I'm still very early in my learning curve ultimately, because I know that there's a lot more to learn and a lot more to do. And that's exciting to me because, you know, I first started, I thought that this was the only way to do it and that our model was the only approach. And it's actually good news. I found that there's many ways to go about improving our watersheds, our grasslands, our relationship with food and with each other. And it's so context dependent though. And that's where, you know, holistic management really shines. And holistic management is essentially a decision-making approach to managing complexity. So it takes all of the complications that often remain in the background that can sabotage the best laid plans. So social complexities, you know, issues with families. It takes the financial, all of the finances into account that can crop up with nasty surprises. And it takes, you know, most importantly, I think that the ecosystem into account,
right,
which is what is the most often left out in favor of managing for the social piece or especially the financial piece. And in fact, in its grazing application, really coordinates all of the needs of the stakeholders. So that would be, you know, myself as operator in the field. That would mean my boss as someone who's, you know, crafted this system. That would be the ecologists here. And that would be the animals, you know, the ones doing arguably most of the work.
Right, they're doing
and that would be,
yes.
Yeah. And, you know, stakeholders include, in my mind, they include the breeding bird population. You know, they include the tadpoles in the pond that I
spent
out before.
before
hopping on the ATV to get back to my truck so I could have a clear phone call with you amidst this happy rainstorm. So it's, you know, the legacy of agriculture has been to simplify and reduce ecology such that humans are holding the reins and controlling as many variables as possible to produce a predictable, reliable, truly, you know, genuinely commodifiable product. And holistic management has allowed an increasing number of livestock producers to, in fact, sort of be on the right side of nature.
Instead
take all of these variables into account, and instead of trying to control them, trying to ally our production goals with the ecological, economic, and social realities. You know, and I mean, an example of that is with holistic planned grazing, we create a grazing chart, and on that chart, you are supposed to put down things like a family reunion you have to go to, you know, or, you know, date night with your partner, whatever the case may be, these things that are so easily left out. And, you know, as you mentioned, ranching can be really hard, and there are some ways of doing it that are a bit more brutal and some that are a bit more hands-off, but all in all, it takes an incredible amount of, at the very least, psychic responsibility, if not being physically and financially and emotionally invested every hour of the day. And so if you don't plan for rest, for recuperation, not just for the grasslands and for the animals, but for yourself, then, you know, I can say from experience, the entire system is sabotaged. And that's been one of my biggest lessons this past year. One of my most impactful professional lessons is that if I don't manage my own house personally, because managing animals takes so much of you, it takes so much attention and so much physicality. If I don't have my house in order, then I can't show up
When I said that, it is absolutely, like, I'm going to say it again, kick-ass work. It is, I was like, oh my gosh, and lifting this and going this and the schedule. And like I said, there's not a day off unless you have a backup plan. And, you know, I want to ask you a little bit about, it's kind of jumping ahead, but when you're talking about this and the holistic management and on, a couple of years ago, I had on a guest that I absolutely loved the interview, and it was Alan Savory. And his, you know, read it, did the research, wanted to go see what he's managing on, you know, around Albuquerque and the restoration of the soil and on. And then I got some, like, scathing, you know, you know what I got. Like, that is not true. It can't scale. It won't work. He makes these audacious claims. And I never completed the loop, because you hear my tagline, we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to.
Sure.
So I welcome...
Which I appreciate so much.
Yes, I welcome it when people come to me and to the show and say, you know, this premise is absolutely, you know, it's kind of like nirvana, and it's not down here on earth, and especially the part about can it scale. And I remember when I heard you at Bioneers, what you do is to me real, because of the size of the land that you take on, like 4,000 acres, and what you do with it and how it is monitored. I mean, I really did my homework, plus I listened to you and what you said about it's not 100,000 acres somewhere on wherever it might be. Is it scalable? That's my question. I mean, is it, or do you have to do it the way you did it, one piece at a time?
Yeah, I mean, I really think you hit the nail on the head. It is scalable one piece at a time, which I think is dissatisfying to some people, perhaps. But again, the legacy of agriculture has been to start too big. And if you start too big, then you're going to explode things to the scale that you are considering them from, instead of starting at the scale of consideration that honors the complexity in place. And that sounds really abstract. But,
no, it doesn't.
You know, an example is that, for example, grass-fed beef is, the industry is growing incredibly rapidly. And I don't want to defend grass-fed beef as a whole, because there's, you know, you can have a product that's grass-fed and grass-finished, and it still isn't necessarily sustainable, let alone restorative in its environment. So I want to be very clear, and we can talk more about kind of about that issue. But just to use that as an example, the reason that grass-fed beef is scaling so fast, well, one of the reasons, it's not because the entire beef industry decided to, you know, within 20 years, make this rapid transition. It's because producer after producer after producer is finding that they can produce a healthier product, have often healthier animals at lower input, and sell their product for either a higher price or you know, a same price with lower cost.
Okay, first break. How can this be? We are in a time warp. Everybody, stay here with us. More from Ariel Greenwood. Hanging on to her every word. We'll be right back.
That was fast.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and SpeakUp networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks so much for being with us and having time fly with us. Joining us for this hour is Ariel Greenwood, the feral agrarian. Love, love, love that. Who also bears the title, I'm having so much fun with your titles, of herdist and naturalist. I mean, I get the naturalist, but I mean, like I said, I never met a herdist. Ariel lives in the Greater Bay Area on a $4,000 acre ecological preserve where she manages a herd of cattle as a grazier for holistic ag, which we're going to talk a little bit more about, among many other things. So let's go back to that conversation about, you know, honoring the complexity and scale. And, you know, you've got 20 minutes till another break. So really tell us about that, because it's one of the most critical takeaways from understanding what you're doing and why it matters.
Yeah, I think it's pretty critical, too. And so critical that I struggle to find exactly the right words. But it's essentially, I guess I would say that where you start has a lot to say about where you end up. So what that means in grassland management and with animals and in the beef industry as a whole and in the sustainability of beef as a whole is we can only graze, we can only produce enough beef, for example, in keeping with the environment as the environment provides.
Yes, yes.
Which is sort of a cyclical way of saying.
But it's true.
Uh-huh. So can it scale? What's often implicit in that question is, can we meet current, let's say, American appetite for red meat with grass-fed or especially with planned grazing, you know, which is sort of an especially ecologically focused form of grass-fed beef? And the answer is, I don't know, but I'm not really interested in meeting current consumption of a product that is perhaps illegitimate to begin with.
Love it.
So in other words,
yes, I get it.
I don't think that we should be evaluating the legitimacy of a production system that is incorporating all of the costs that are externalized by another production system based on the production system that's been failing our environment and our health for so long.
Right.
So
it's rotten from the core. I can say that. It's rotten from the core. It started all wrong. Isn't that a better way to say it? Yeah.
So, and there's a lot of nuances in beef production, and I am intent to not vilify what you might call conventional ranchers who are either finishing their own animals on grain or raising livestock to sell calves to be finished by another entity to be sold to, you know, the mass market, because we're all working within the context available to us. However, you know, the goal of holistic management is to make our, one of the goals is to make our values about our quality of life, about the ecosystems we want to leave behind us when we die, about you know, the integrity of our finances, to make those aligned with our business practices. And, you know, there's this thing in ranching where it's extremely hard work, but it's also often very beautiful work. However, I think that there's this perspective among a lot of consumers that, like, ranchers are just masochists.
Oh, man.
Or who who want to just be, you know, working themselves to the bone and are martyrs to the cause. And certainly that's the case for some, but I'm interested in a ranching culture that is, you know, where the producers, where the ranchers, where their quality of life and their welfare is valued in addition to their animals. Because I think that they go hand in hand. And one way we get there is to have our consumers, you know, myself included, because I'm eating the beef that I manage right now that I'm raising, but I'm also a consumer of other animal products. And, you know, I need to be doing my part to make sure that I have an understanding of what the life is like, not just for the animal, but for the person raising that animal and for the ecosystem that it was raised in. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. And the other part of that is you're doing it so differently. And I really love it that you don't want to vilify. There are big ag operations that deserve vilification in some cases.
Sure.
But I understand what you're saying, because if you meet a rancher that is connected to their land and their animals, there's nothing to vilify. They are passionate. They are not miserable. They are doing it because they love it. And they're out there as excited as I get up every day being Mrs. Green and all that that means for me. I have spent time with ranchers, and it is their love. It is their life, and they care deeply. So you're absolutely right about what they say. And in some cases, it's a whole different story when you get into, you know, massive, you know, raising of beef.
Yeah.
There's a really ugly side to it. But I want to ask this before I forget it, which you're telling
sure.
such a story, I'm forgetting that I have anything to do here because I want to hear the story. And that's awesome. It's what I want. But when you literally manage the land, and I got that very clear, we can talk more about what holistic ag does, because that is so important in the decision making and, you know, evaluating animal impact. What kind of conversations are you having as a community? And that's another thing that maybe I made up, but it became very clear to me about this is a community that you're a part of, and looking at pictures and saying, I want to be in that picture, but just not do the work. And then, but what do you have conversations about in terms of climate change? You can't predict it, but when you're managing it as really, and I mean that really, and as holistically as you are, there are changes. And you said it's raining today. So we have floods and we have droughts and we have things that are way beyond our control at this point. What kind of conversations are you having as people really connected and really caring about what are you going to do? Is there a plan for that? I mean, does that question make sense to you?
Yeah. I mean, it's a broad question, but I think I understand what you're asking. And I should say, you know, I am in a unique geographical location as someone in ranching.
Gorgeous.
It's very different from a lot of the, it's beautiful, but it's culturally very different from a lot of where you might say most ranching happens in the U.S. at least, which is, I think, arguably in sort of a intermountain western state. So here I am, you know, within 15 miles from the coast in one of the most expensive counties to live in the country. I'm, you know, I'm in Northern California, but as my ranching mentors a little further north say, this is not really Northern California. This is still kind of Bay Area. And so, you know, I'm in the same general region as places like the Carbon Cycle Institute and the Marin Carbon Project, you know, these places that are doing a lot of pioneering science and experimentation and outreach and education surrounding the role of grazing and compost and soil carbon and climate. So, and of course, I'm, you know, I'm managing animals in a nature preserve. And part of, you know, as you probably ascertained, this whole gaggle of grazer and grazer groupies, all of which have a very important part to play. And so the questions that we're, the things we're talking about lately, there's been a refreshing amount of humility in the conversations I'm having with other practitioners, because we're coming out of a really wet winter. I think we got, I think it's close to, it's around 70 inches, maybe more. So like, I think double our average, a lot more than we got my first winter here on this land base. And just keeping, you know, in my case, 60 tons of animal on the move in a way that's beneficial to the ecosystem and not a detriment. It's the problem that everybody's been having. And so, you know, on the one hand, it's nice to have rain and moisture, but, you know, the flip side of global weirding, as my friend Brock puts it, is that
I love
you
it.
Can have
I love
all
that
of
term. It's so true.
Yeah. Global weirding, because you can have all of the moisture but none of the sun. And of course, plants need both to photosynthesize and grow. And we need growing plants to not just feed cows, but feed soil so that we can actually get carbon from the atmosphere into living plants and into the soil where it's stable in perpetuity. So that's some of the conversation, is just how do we keep this thing going economically and sometimes just physically? Because
yes.
if you're moving animals at two or three times the rate that you typically would, it's exhausting. And it's demoralizing sometimes. And I want to touch back on that because there's something I'm trying to put my finger on related to sort of public notions of ranchers and grazers. And it's not as if we are masochist. It is very hard work, but it's work that it's beautiful and it's meaningful if it is supported by the public and by consumers. So in other words,
yes.
like I like to say this thing, like the trouble with regenerative agriculture is that somebody actually has to do it. Like for all of this talking about it, you know, and I have some friends who are knee deep in it who kind of roll their eyes at some of the hubbub about it in the public fear, even though ultimately the excitement translates into, at the very least, more support for our products and hopefully policy change and shift in our consciousness. But it's absolutely true. Like the notion of producing an agricultural product from a land that actually leaves that land better by virtue of producing something, it's kind of radical. And humans have not done it since we started agriculture 12,000 years ago. There's been some horticultural societies that have managed at meaningful scale to have these really diversified sort of agro ecosystems, but done at the scale we insist that it has to happen, we haven't really managed. So I think we're able to do it now, but only if not only people do it, but people pay for it. So that's the flip side of it, is that regenerative agriculture, products from regenerative agriculture costs more than products from conventional agriculture. So to me, the question is, how do we build affection and a sense of affinity and connectedness between, you know, in my case, my beef customers and my product? How do I invite them into this to where they understand it's not a matter of do I eat meat or not meat? It's a matter of how do I help steward the grassland and oak ecosystems in my bioregion? And I think if you center agriculture on the place in which it's produced, then so many questions about how we do it in a way that's equitable for all involved are answered. But the trouble is that we still have to pay for it, you know?
Yes, and I think it's great to get to that. But it is great to get to that. And it even, you know, this newest thing for me is how do I flip it? Because I'm always concerned. Because of my background, the champion of the underdog, and, you know, poor people can't afford this beef, and on. But the better conversation to me, which just really happened, is that there are other changes that can be made so that people that in the other end of the socioeconomic spectrum can still make healthier choices, can still afford organic vegetables with a mindset shift, and I would like to talk about that. But what you're doing to me is for the benefit of everybody. Because if you help with mitigating climate change, which I truly believe you do, and you're raising healthy cattle and happy cattle, which matters to me too, and they're being consumed in a way that is, you know, that it's ethical. It's the whole enchilada of the way we used to eat meat, right? Not mass production. We all do benefit. Even those people that can't buy your beef, there's a benefit to the air quality that we contribute to. I say to people, do you understand that when you're cutting trees down in the rainforest in Peru, it's hurting us right here in, you know, the United States? So this winded way that I'm taking to bring us back is it's inherently good, and restoring grasslands is inherently good. And the other part of it is, I say to people, my daughter, when she was going through a really hard time in her life, she just said, I'm still going to feed my kids the highest quality of food, and I am going to make other choices. Another person from my staff, before she started working for me, I want to do a disclaimer, she said, when I was unemployed and on food stamps, I decided I was going to eat healthy no matter what. So lots of other things in her life had to be cut out. Taking on a roommate, there were no lattes in her budget. But there is a mindset shift. I better say that carefully because I already cursed once on the show. is that if you make conscious and mindful choices, it's rethinking the budget. And you might want to have, beans and rice or, healthy corn and 4 times a week, and then buy some really good ethically raised, grass-fed, hormone-free beef as the one time a week that you eat beef. Does that whole tirade make sense?
It does. And yet at the same time, I think a lot of the culture surrounding small, sustainable, regenerative farming and the products that come from those farming systems, at least here in the U.S., it is often a very white and very privileged culture.
Thank you for saying that.
And to the extent that I had this revelation recently, and I'll give a little bit of context. So in my reading, I've been intentionally reading books, whether novels or autobiographies, nonfiction books by Black and Brown authors, and trying to pursue also like more women authors too.
Right.
And I've been reading this book that is by a woman describing her childhood and teenage years in Somalia amidst basically clans, these tribes, these desert dwelling tribes, and subsequent civil wars that broke out and political instability and religious persecution and so on. And I've never been so moved by someone's account of their life before. It definitely put a lot of my Sonoma County problems into perspective.
So
but
right.
The common theme among all of the things that she's saying is that these people that she's describing in her life are victims of their circumstance because they can't sustain their own livelihoods on the land that they were born into or the land that they migrated to. And so they're instantly, from the moment they are born, political refugees. They're essentially political victims because they cannot just feed and clothe themselves or their families where they happen to live.
That's right. And they can't just move either. They can't just move.
And of course,
huge.
Those who can, exactly. And those who can, like the mass exodus from Syria that we're seeing, a lot of the problems there. I don't pretend to be an expert in global politics, or from what I understand, a huge contributor to those issues is that essentially these people are climate refugees. So reading this work and putting two and two together, it occurred to me, this whole local food thing, it's not just about celebrating San Marzano tomatoes and, seasonal squash and taking photos around the brunch table. It's so much more. It's about a livelihood that doesn't subjugate other people and other animals and other soil and other watersheds. If you are able to guarantee the equity of the food that you're eating, it means that you are not inadvertently compromising someone else, and you're nourishing yourself in your own watershed to boot. So that's, increasingly I would like for us to think about our food as direct action. It is participatory ecology, and it's also our own political activism, if only because we're not then causing someone else to suffer somewhere else where we don't see, because of our need to meet our needs.
What a wonderful thing to say. And, I always talk to people about goosebumps don't lie. You can't fake goosebumps. You just really can't. It's like, I can't fake my tears and goosebumps. So many times when you're talking, and to me, bringing in the whole social justice piece of this is my walk as Mrs. Green, because it is a whole landscape. It is not just about, you know, if I can afford the beef. It's where did it come from? Who was harmed in the making of this device? I mean, it's so much more. It's the food chain.
It is. But, you know, at the same time, it's like, it's been difficult for me in ranching, even this sort of California ranching culture.
Okay, hold that thought. We are perfect at the timing. Hold on, the flip side. We'll be right back with Ariel Greenwood. Hang on.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's world is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thank you for being a part of our world. And listen to that little promo. My team reminds me that sustainers sustain us, so that we can bring amazing shows like this, raise your environmental IQ, work to the goal of creating a world that works for everyone and a sustainable planet. So if you have any commitment to any of this issue and are loving what you're hearing, consider going to my website at MrsGreensWorld.com, and there is a big button that says Become a Member, and we'd love to have you. Okay, that I rarely do that commercial, but when I have shows like this, it's like we want to grow. We want to penetrate more markets, and it's all good. So we are spending this hour, which seems like 5 minutes, with Ariel Greenwood.
I know.
It does. It's like, I cannot believe it. The feral agrarian, she lives, and I'm going to go, in the Greater Bay Area on 4,000 acres. She's a herdist. But I want to talk about what you're doing, because there's 15 more questions I have, which we're never going to get to. But we're getting to what really matters. You're really creating this global picture of it's not just a food chain, it's a human chain, and it's all connected. And, you know, I had Ron Guerin, who's an astronaut and incredible, and talks about the worldview. When you're looking at space for 6 months from a spaceship, you don't see boundaries, and you don't see earnings per share or, you know, the economy. You see a planet with all, you know, all connected, and how important that is. And I love the picture that you're painting for us and the passion. So where did we leave off? I'm so...
Well, you know, you mentioned that the social justice piece, and I really think social justice, ecological justice, and, you know, justice for animals, they're all completely connected. And
I
was starting to talk about how, you know, I got into ranching from primarily ecological motivations. You know, I was learning about ecology and grassland ecosystems and the role of well-managed ruminants to serve as a biomimetic replication.
You know, my
of
favorite word,
the,
biomimicry. I love it. Now I know what that is, too. I love it.
Yeah, of the impact that a lot of our ecosystem here in North America was formed by these large animals. And so I, you know, the whole ranching thing and having to now create a beef brand, my beef brand is called Circle A Beef, and so I sell that to my Bay Area community. And I'm learning a lot. It's a total crash course in, you know, being a small business owner, and I'm learning a lot about beef and everything in between. But ultimately, my motives were first and foremost ecological, and I'm finding that, of course, if you have these ecological goals, something has to pay for it. But nonetheless, like, you know, I'm a blonde white woman in ranching, and
drop dead gorgeous. I mean, let's just add that, drop dead gorgeous. Just look at her website.
Thanks. Well, but really, I mentioned the color of my skin and my hair, because I find that, you know, here I am looking around, and I look just like a lot of other people in ranching. And I, you know, I go to ranching conferences and symposiums and hang out with my pals, and we all look ultimately kind of the same. There's not a lot of diversity in it. And, you know, the more I study about the history of ranching in the West, you know, ranching is a pretty colonial form of pastoralism. And pastoralism is something we've been doing a really long time. Humans of every skin color all around the world have been taking sheep or goats or yaks or water buffalo or cattle and so on out into the hills and the valleys for many millennia. And yet here in the West, it's tied up with water rights, with land theft, with subjugation of Native people and, you know, the Chicano population and so on. And so it's funny, I feel like I have to actively reckon with, you know, to what extent have doors been opened for me because of my looking the part, and how can I step through those doors, but instead of letting them close behind me in the sort of common scarcity economic modality we operate in, how can I then step through that door, but hold not only it open, but hopefully create a few more doors in what were, you know, solid walls so that more people can come into this. And, you know, I don't think everybody needs to be a rancher or a grazer, but I do know that if someone wants to have an intimate connection with animals, with land, with just grass and trees and rocks and soil, there's few professions that will put you so intimately and also so expansively, you know, in that relationship. So from this sort of rewilding perspective, not just of land, but also of the human spirit, you know, I think we need pastoralism to be a viable, legitimate vocation for many more people than who can currently access it in the way ranching is today. We need to change that. In fact, because, you know, what we are finding out from all of the science that's emerging surrounding great, you know, managed grazing and grassland health and especially carbon shows that we should have been populating the valleys and hillsides with grazers, herders, shepherds, and lots of animals, you know, 40 years ago.
Right.
So
right.
That land is revitalized and is pumping carbon into the soil where it will stay. And so we're way behind the ball. So there's a lot of economic bottlenecks to that, but there's also a lot of just social bottlenecks and cultural things that, you know, I hope I can help play a part in shifting in my time on the planet.
And raising the consciousness about it. And, you know, I just had this great idea. We should just do an all-night radio talk show call-in so that people can have this.
Fun.
It's like, I'm barely kidding, but when you're taking a much deeper cut, which I love, and I feel that that's the next 10 years of Mrs. Green's world because of going to all of these conferences and the cross-pollination and the people that I get to meet. And I worked for most of my career with what are now being called more marginalized communities and at-risk populations. And I mean really spending time there with them, becoming friends, not just quote-unquote providing services, like getting to know them, what do you need? And it's one of the reasons why my companies were so successful. And what I didn't know, because we are a product of our environment. So many of these kids that I just loved, what are you talking about, a farm? They don't even know what that is. They don't see snow. Like if you live in the desert, a cow would terrify them. So the experience is not even one that's available to them. And that's the part that makes me sad. So how do we create programs and interactions? And, you know, I wonder about this internship program that I don't know if you lot about it, but I lit up. Not because I want to do it, but the 6-month grazing immersion program, like who shows up? Is there anything that shifts? Because you make such a good point, brown and black people. Did you ever see the special on Oprah camping? Like you would die laughing because she says black people don't camp. My friend who managed.
Well, think about it. I mean, I'm from the Southeast, so, you know, surrounded by old tobacco fields that were, you know, depending on how far east they went, used to be cotton fields or corn. And, you know, there's a deeply troubled legacy there.
Not a good memory there.
No. And so it's cool for us, like, you know, liberal arts educated white people to come gallivanting into this and like take a bunch of pictures and have fun with it, you know. But at the same time, I have to remind myself, A, that probably most of the things that I need to be thinking about, I don't even know what they are. And so staying in conversation with people very different from me, as a matter of course, is critical.
The books you're reading. I want to know the name of that book. I want to know the name of that book about the woman from Somalia. I do.
Because, the book is called Infidel.
Okay.
Well, that's, and it's by Ayan Hirsi Ali, I think is her name, but I can email it to you. And
I've got Google, so, you know, if I put down Woman from Somalia, Infidel, and book, it'll come up, but it's really important.
It's a pretty controversial book, but I'm learning a lot about, you know, how some people see the world and a lot of people's experience of it, in contrast to my genteel Sonoma County world.
Yeah, it rocks it. It does rock it, and I love it. I mean, I remember when I went to this Cultivating Women's Leadership, which Nina Simons puts on with, you know, some of the other people, Toby Herzlich and all that, we had to watch this film on white privilege. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, I'm not prejudiced and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, that is not what white privilege is all about. It's a consciousness.
Right.
Because we grew up, you know, it's not shame, blame, guilt, and you're a racist, which is how I reacted. I'm not a racist. It has nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. I have white privilege because I was born white, and you can't do a disclaimer. It's like, okay, so how do you show up from there? It was.
Yeah, and how do you engage with that in a way where you're not paralyzed and embarrassed, but you're actually being useful to the people who don't have that privilege? And that's something I'm thinking about so much.
A lot,
because,
me too.
You know, a lot of the attention that I get is not from people in the ranching community, you know, who probably are waiting. They're waiting to see if I stick around. It's from people who are beyond the ranching community who think that what I do is interesting, and I so appreciate that support. But at the same time, I have to remember that, you know, I don't want to absorb that attention for myself, nor do I want to deflect it back willy-nilly to where it's going, in maybe in a direction away from people who actually need that. I would like to steward it to the best of my ability and pass it on to other producers, other people whose story needs to be told and who need to be brought to the conversation, but maybe aren't, you know, immediately given a seat at the table. And I can't pretend to be the best at that, but I'm trying.
Well, yeah, no, you're trying. You're rocking it. I mean, I'm serious. This is like so much fun besides being intentional and on purpose, and people need to pay attention. And every time I see our numbers go up for listeners, I get so excited for the right reason. It's like more people got to hear the amazing stories of the people I have. And I've got a great radar for having engaging and wonderful. You know, like one thing Ron Guerin said, which I'm changing my language about, he said, we really don't need a lot more thought leaders. We need a lot more action leaders.
Right.
And you're what I call an action leader.
There's a lot of good thoughts out there, you know, and the trouble is that thinking, we're no longer at this luxury where we can think our way out of problems. It's like ultimately most of our most pressing problems in the world, I think, have to do with our relationship with nature, which I know a lot of people take up issue with.
Totally agree with you. Totally.
Yeah, Wendell Berry has this quote that, despite it being my favorite quote, I can never actually quote verbatim, but it's something like, you know, a value without a practice is just, you know, another meaningless act of passive consumption. In other words, if we don't have either a direct practice for our values or a relationship with people who can kind of be, you know, maybe in the case of our ecosystem, like an ecological proxy, a manager by proxy, then we don't have a way to actually make things better. And, you know, that being said, like you touched earlier on the issue of food access and how this beef that I produce is often pretty expensive relative to what a lot of people can get. And, you know, I think you're right. I don't have an easy answer for that. I try to do kind of payment programs for friends of mine who are producers or who otherwise couldn't afford, you know, a few hundred bucks right off the bat. But there's...
I read about that, and I said, oh my gosh, she takes layaway for food. Seriously,
yeah,
I mean, that is really a big act. It matters a lot, really and truly.
It's me doing what I can, and like, what we really need is the people who have the economic latitude to step up to the plate more than they have. And, you know, we need climate heroes in the form of people who have either access to lots of land or access to a lot of capital, who are also eaters, which you all are, to be eating the very best and to be in conversation also with producers about, you know, what do you need financially to be able to get to the next level of management? Because a lot of ranchers and farmers, but, you know, ranchers in particular, they don't want to be sending all of their animals off to finish somewhere. A lot of them bred those animals. They want to raise them. They want to finish them and guarantee that they know the life and the death that animal had and where its flesh is going. But to shift from, for example, a cow-calf situation to, you know, direct marketing is a radical change for a lot of producers, and they need economic support on the part of their community to do so. So where I think a lot of the sort of food movement has gone askew is just emphasizing just buying the right stuff, when really what we need, and I don't have any easy answers for this, but we need the conversations between consumers who have some economic flexibility and producers who have a lot of great ideas and the capacity to actualize them on them, but very slim margins, to come together over the dinner table and form creative solutions for how, you know, the shift to a new level of management can be buffered and supported by those who have the economic means of doing so. And then we're all ecological activists and stewards, not just the people on the land every day.
And it's what you, I mean, it's the holistic planning model, where you actually bring people together. I just had an experience yesterday where it was a conference call about what some of us want to do with this climate reality leadership training. And boy, two minds are better than one. Three minds are exponentially better. And what we started with,
that makes sense, yeah.
Yes, and what we came up with was totally different, but we went along in this creative, collaborative process, which, mm-hmm. by the way, a lot of times it is women. I like to throw that in now and then, because there are some great things I've been witnessing, but to the exclusion of no one is what I think. And what I also think is that I really want people who are listening to the show to consider going to your blog. We didn't get a chance to talk about it. I think we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, but I don't want to go through the show without saying that you have a website, and it's arielgreenwood.com. That's the portal where you go down the rabbit hole. So plan to spend some time. And then there's Twitter, and it's Greenwood AE. And then there's Instagram, and it's Grassland Greenwood, and they're all active. I kind of loved, in a very sick way, that you didn't have Facebook, because I'm so, like, I'm thrilled to have it for Mrs. Green's World, but with what you're doing, there's no time. I don't know how you have time to write blogs.
Yeah. Well, I have a Facebook page for my beef, which is Circle A Beef.
Okay.
Go through it, iterations. Yeah. But my website has links to my Twitter and Instagram account, if anybody wants to tag along on whatever I get into next.
And read your blogs. And I think that you should check, because I tried linking to Instagram on your website, and the link didn't work for me. So I went into Instagram and searched you. And I always love it when people tell me that, so that you can check it out. You know, sometimes they do an upgrade to the system and people will call me and tell me it doesn't work.
I changed my Instagram name, so I think I just need to edit my website with that. Yeah. But yeah, I hope people will stay in conversation with me, because I appreciate feedback.
And everybody eats, and the conversation about beef is without a doubt one of the most controversial. You know, people say to me, I feel guilty of eating beef in front of you. I'm like, why would you say that? I eat beef. You know, I mean, come on over to Graze in Tucson, Arizona, and we call it the guilt-free burger. Know it. And another point I want to give to people: in every city, town, no matter how big or small, the proliferation of farmers markets blows my mind. I'm sure someone's tracking the growth. So if you have a farmers market in your town, in your village, in your city, you need to know who it is that you're buying it from, because it's not a given. Just because they're at a farmers market, it's all good and healthy and, you know, kumbaya. But farmers markets are a great place. And remember that shift in mindset, everybody, that we talked about, is that, yes, it might be a lot more expensive for these 3 dozen eggs, but you really can do away with 4 lattes and you'll come out net positive. So it's all about redesigning the budget. And a quick shout out, April 27th, Nicole White and Leslie Waters, a great show about Tucson Electric Power and their tree program, planting trees all over Pima County. And then for our national show, I can't wait for this one, Jack Angelini and Ian Reisenberger, weaving together corporate and community. And it's Timberland and this man from a company called Thread. And it is all about where we're sourcing our clothing, the filthy fashion industry, and what they're doing to revolutionize that. So, Ariel Greenwood, I don't know what to say except thank you for showing up in my world, for what you're doing. And I can't wait for our paths to cross. So make it a great green. Have a healthy burger day, everybody. Thank you, Ariel.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Talk to you later.